Over the past several weeks, we have worked through some of Jesus' teachings that are recorded in Matthew chapter 5. We're going to kind of conclude that series this morning. But as we've walked through these places where Jesus kind of starts with an Old Testament teaching, you've heard it said, this, and then he moves beyond to point us further into the heart of God. As we've walked through that, it's been fairly easy, if you've been paying attention, to see a common thread. The real obvious common thread is that we need to seek to love others by affirming the image of God in them. What we may have not noticed, at least not consciously, is that each step we've taken along this way of teaching, it's gotten a little bit more personal and a little bit more challenging. For example, Jesus starts with, you've heard it said, do not murder. Most of us are like, okay, yeah, obvious. But Jesus tells his hearers that when they have this real physical power to cause harm to others, rather than using it to cause harm, they need to honor the image of God in them and pursue reconciliation with the individual. Then he moves on, and he says, you know, instead of saying don't commit adultery, Jesus instructs those that have a social power over an entire group of people. Remember, he talks about, you know, even if you think lustfully about them, you're already doing it. It's talking about this sort of kind of social dynamic where men who have this social power shouldn't use it negatively, but rather should honor the image of God in those who are a part of that group that they have social power over, should elevate them. Sorry. And then instead of saying it's okay to divorce when it's convenient and as long as you do it legally, Jesus instructs those who have legal power over another to use it in a way that doesn't cast them aside. He calls on those with this legal power to instead honor the image of God in the other by relating to them with sacrificial love. And then instead of emphasizing the importance of honoring vows to God, Jesus instructs those who have that relational power or that oratorical power to not use that to manipulate or game others. Rather, that relational power should be used to create safe and honest spaces where trust is built. Those with this kind of power should honor the image of God in others by living with integrity, letting yes be yes and no be no. Now, in each of those cases, the first four things that we talked about, Jesus is speaking to people who have a power about how to use that power to honor others and to focus on building healthy relationships through love. Then we got last week to a fifth kind of power. This is what Elise spoke about last week. And here we see a shift. In this setting, Jesus is actually talking about those who don't have power. In fact, others have power over them. In each of the examples, at least talked through, the example, like one example was they have social power, one was physical power, one was legal power. In each case, the person Jesus is addressing is the victim that is really powerless to resist. But they're not powerless to love. And by responding with love, the power of the other is disarmed. Even if just for a brief time, and that other person who was previously intent on using their power over another is invited towards love as well. Through each of those five things that Jesus talked about that we've unpacked, there's this issue of power, whether we are the ones with the power or whether we are being subjected to one who has power. We are called to respond by honoring the image of God in the other, by pursuing love and through that to seek to build relationship. So today we come to the sixth and final, you've heard it said, kind of teaching of Jesus. And it might be the hardest of all. These are Jesus' words in Matthew 5, verse 43 to 48. You've heard the law that says, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say, love your enemies. Pray for those who persecute you. In that way, you'll be acting as true children of your Father in heaven, for he gives his sunlight to both the evil and the good, and he sends rain on the just and the unjust alike. If you love only those who love you, what is your reward? What reward is there for that? Even corrupt tax collectors do that much. If you are kind only to your friends, how are you different from anyone else? Even pagans do that. But you are to be perfect, even as your Father in heaven is perfect. I'll point out that in verse 44, some manuscripts include some extra stuff. Some say, bless those who curse you and do good to those who hate you. That makes it very similar to what Luke recorded in Luke 6 when he says, but you who are willing, I say to you, love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you. Pray for those who hurt you. In this context, Jesus starts with something that's taken from Leviticus, where the Old Testament people are told to love their neighbor. In Leviticus 19:18, the law says, do not seek revenge or bear a grudge against a fellow Israelite, but love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord. Now, based on that command, that they were to love their neighbor, and the fact that in that Leviticus context, it was clearly neighbor was like the one who was related to them ethnically, the fellow Israelite. They deduced that, okay, we're supposed to love our neighbor, but that means obviously it's okay to hate our enemies. And if you read through their history, it seems like a common idea was we can hate our enemies because obviously God hates them too. As such, it wasn't just that they could hate their enemies, but they probably should. It's kind of how it played itself out. I think we can relate to that. If you ever notice that when we think about how God thinks about the people that we don't like, we tend to think God thinks the same of them as we do. But in this teaching, rather than being a power dynamic of whether you're the one with power or someone else has the power, the question of power is removed from the equation. Enemies may have power, but they may not. The Romans, for example, had power in Jesus' day, and they were enemies. The Samaritans, by and large, did not have power. They were also enemies. An enemy may or may not have power, but an enemy certainly wants to have power against you. But power is not really what's at stake here. I should clarify, an enemy is not someone that you simply have a grudge against, or they have a grudge against you, or you disagree with each other on something. An enemy isn't something where, well, there's a misunderstanding and maybe time will heal this. In this context, an enemy is one who has set themselves against you with a desire or an intent to harm. Like they are set against you in a way that really longs to see you hurt or suffer. According to the law, when that happens and they set themselves against you, you've got free rein to hate them. In fact, it's almost expected that you should. It's expected that you would respond in kind because they are in opposition to you. But Jesus comes along and says, love your enemies. Bless those who curse you. Do good to those who hate you. Pray for those who persecute you. And he very explicitly shows, as we read through this, that he's pointing beyond the law into the very heart of God. He continues by saying, in that way, by responding with love and blessings and goodness and prayer, by responding with love, you will be acting as true children of your Father in heaven. This is pretty bold when he's talking to people who, A, they believe that they are the children of God, and they believe that as such, they actually should hate those who are opposed to them, because if they're opposed to them, then they're obviously in opposition to God. This is a radical teaching. Then he supports this understanding of the heart of God with some really simple logic. God doesn't withhold his provision and good for people because they are evil or because they're at odds with God or God's people. He says, no, God gives the sunlight to both the evil and the good. And he sends rain to the just and unjust alike. Now, both the sunlight and the rain were good gifts. You need them both. If you aren't sure you need them both, just talk to a farmer. These were good gifts. And he's saying God gives these gifts to everybody. Every day, God shows that his heart is to give good things, even to people who stand in opposition to God's heart, even those who are hurting and harming the world that God has made good. God's response to those who set themselves up as enemies of God is to love them, even if they aren't aware of that love. Jesus goes on to point out that there's nothing divinely inspired or holy about loving those who love you in return. To make this point, he uses the example of some people who, to his hearers, acted in the most selfish and opportunist of ways, the tax collectors. A tax collector was someone who had turned their backs on their own Jewish people to work for the occupying Roman powers. Not only that, but a tax collector then used deceit in order to get rich on the backs of their own people. You know, Romans were enemies because of birth and because they were following orders. Tax collectors, they chose to be enemies, and they profited from it. But even those horrible tax collectors, they love those who love them in return. Even pagans, those who make no claim to try and follow the heart of God, love people who love them. So when you're doing that, you're not doing anything special. Those who claim to be following the heart of God and living the way of God are called to something radically different. Love. Love that is shown even to your enemies, whether they are the occupying Romans trying to kill you, the Samaritans who your people wish you could get rid of, the tax collector who is profiting off of you, or people in a closer sphere of relationship who, for some reason or another, have set themselves up in opposition to you, have set themselves up as your enemies. People following the heart of God are called to respond with love. And then Jesus concludes with this unbelievably high bar. He says, but you are to be perfect, even as your Father in heaven is perfect. With this last phrase, Jesus leaves no room for our inevitable excuses. Okay, Jesus, love my enemies, but you don't know what they did to me. Okay, Jesus, love my enemies, but look at the harm they're causing. Surely you don't mean them. Okay, Jesus, love your enemies, but those people. No, God is love, and we are to continue moving in the direction of love. As Jesus says this, I don't think that there is an expectation that we will become perfect on this side of eternity. But the clear invitation is to keep growing in that direction and learning to respond in this way. The goal, even if we don't arrive this side of eternity, the goal is perfection. And perfection is loving in a way that aligns with God's heart, no matter how much someone sets themselves up against us as enemies. And to help us know how to love, because that's a big one. Like, so how do we love? Does that mean we just excuse everything that they've done? Does that mean we just ignore things? Jesus actually shows us in this passage how to love. After he says you need to love your enemies, he says this. He says, pray for those who persecute you. There are three things that go along with this, and I think we can talk about them. And they aren't all in this passage. They're in the Luke passage, and they are in some manuscripts. But bless those who curse you, do good to those who hate you, pray for those who persecute you. Let's think about those three things here, three things that help us to love. The first, bless those who curse you. That means you're speaking well of others and to others. Speak with blessings, not with curses. Speaking with a blessing doesn't mean affirming their actions and behavior. It also doesn't mean kind of the Southern passive-aggressive, you know, bless your heart kind of thing. It means actually speaking in ways that long for their best. And longing for their best doesn't mean affirming what they want. It means that you choose not to engage in the gossip and the heart. Don't speak to them in the same way they are speaking of you. It means, as we've said over and over again in this series, seeing and honoring the image of God in them, even if they aren't doing that to you, and speaking in that way about them and to them. So bless those who curse you. The next thing, do good to those who hate you. Do good to them. Respond with good. It helps to break down the walls between you and the other and invites them to no longer relate to you as an enemy. It's good to note that this idea didn't originate with Jesus. All the way back in Proverbs 25, these Proverbs is this collection of general wisdom, like helpful stuff for life. And Proverbs 25 says, if your enemies are hungry, give them food to eat. If they're thirsty, give them water to drink. You'll heap burning coals of shame on their heads, and the Lord will reward you. Proverbs is intensely practical. It's actually not a particularly spiritual book. It's intensely practical. It's like, practically speaking, if you respond with love, it's more likely that they're going to get ashamed and things are going to be better for you. We love them by doing good for them, just as we love them by speaking well of them. And then the last one, pray for them. We intercede on their behalf to God. We don't just wish them well and do good. We pray to God for their best, that the God who is working in the world would provide for them and work his will out for their lives by drawing them to him. Through these three things, we can love well even in the face of conflict. Our time is limited. I would love to have some time to just have your questions and thoughts on this. I don't know if we'll have it. I do want to share two quick stories, examples of how this can play itself out. One example picks up on something we talked about last week. It's kind of a large-scale situation. Last week we talked about conscientious objectors in our church history, in our Anabaptist tradition. I remember Ron Sider talking about how should those of us who say we want to follow Jesus well approach the idea of war and conflict. And he just said, well, Jesus tells us to love our enemies, and it's hard to love them when we're trying to kill them. It's frustratingly simple, and yet it's really hard to live out. And in our BIC history, there were draftees, or those who were conscripted, and they sought to love their German enemies by refusing to take up weapons against them. That's an easy example, but they weren't the only enemies that these ones who were conscripted had to learn to love during the war. Because when they didn't join the army, even though they were conscripted, they had many wearing Canadian uniforms who set themselves against them very aggressively. Canadian conscientious objectors faced mistreatment and harm at the hands of Canadian soldiers while they were in military prisons. E.J. Swallum, I read part of his testimony last week, he told about guards coming and with revolvers and playing Russian roulette with them. They served time in the Kingston Penitentiary, and all because they sought to follow this hard teaching of Jesus, what put them at odds with society as a whole. But they didn't choose hate. They wrote about working hard to maintain love for their Canadian guards who set themselves up as their enemies during this time. And as I read the stories, I was deeply impacted by how they sought to even speak well of those that beat them and tried to harm them. They sought to understand where they were coming from and sought to bless them, do good to them, and pray for them. More personal example comes from my own experience. I served as a lead pastor in a previous church, and I'd been there less than a month when someone met with me and told me outright that they wanted me gone. They actively stirred up trouble against me from the beginning, and before long, other significant voices in the church had joined. And it wasn't mere disagreement. It was over 2 years of being attacked and maligned and lied about. I struggled with how to respond. And eventually, thanks to some wise counsel, I committed to the three practices that Jesus talks about above. I worked hard to bless them and not to curse them. I sought to do good in the face of harm, and I began to pray really hard for their best. I was honest with God about the hurt I felt, and I was honest with God about how terrible I felt their actions were, But I also sought to genuinely pray to God for good in their lives and that their hearts would be turned to good. And through these things, I sought to love. Now, I would love to stand here and tell you it was amazing. I did these three things and everything turned awesome. It didn't. They continued to put themselves against me as enemies to the point where mediators that came to try and help us, they affirmed my attempts to love well and then told me, you need to get out of here to save yourself. On one hand, love didn't work to resolve relationships. But at a much deeper level, love worked because I was able to walk away without deep resentment and hatred towards them, without ill will to those who were doing things to me. I walked away with a level of love. I also walked away with a lot of trauma and a lot of wounds that still carry the marks of, but the pain I carry from that experience is heartache, not hatred. I'll also say that when I reflect on that time, I need to continue to practice those things so that the heartache doesn't grow into hatred, because I know it easily can. You know, we don't have time, but I'm going to open the floor if you have any thoughts or questions. We do have a microphone so that those online can hear. Anything anyone else would like to say, contribute before we wrap up? Yeah, Wayne. I'm just going to wait for Joe to get you a mic just so people online can hear.
I have a question concerning the Holocaust.
Yeah.
Okay. How can you love the people that did that?
I will say, I don't think Jesus calls us to love our enemies in a naive way that says that pretends it's easy. I think at the heart of it is those who are dehumanizing others, we need to make sure we don't respond in kind. And it doesn't mean that we ignore or pretend that what happened wasn't horrible. You ask how. I think going back to the other things that we talked about is the only kind of real practical things I can say is work hard to honor the image of God in them through how we speak of the people, even while we acknowledge the horror of what they have done. Pray that God would do his work in them. And when given the opportunity, don't respond in kind in our actions. I think it's important. I have this as something I was going to share right at the end, but when it talks about in the face of evil, how do we respond? I mentioned Ron Sider shared that pretty simple teaching, hard to love someone when you're trying to kill them. In that same talk, we got into the issue of how do you restrain evil? And he was asked very directly, so if there's a person there who is like trying to harm you or hurt you or hurt people around you, like how far would you go to restrain them? And as a matter of factly as he could, he's like, oh, I'd taser them. Because it's a non-lethal attempt to restrain so that you can prevent the evil that's going on. And then hopefully move them towards good from there. I don't have clear answers as to how that works on a huge scale. I was talking with actually Brent and Leticia and Angie the other last week, and I did think, you know, what would it look like if we took all of the effort and energy and money that has been going into creating weapons that kill and put it into weapons that could restrain without a lethal intent? I don't know what that would look like. I'm not an engineer, but I have to think that we could come up with some pretty cool things that could work to that end rather than simply resorting to they're killing, so we need to kill more faster. Again, I don't have an answer to that. I do think you point out a huge thing, though, Wayne, in saying, like, this is not easy. It's incredibly difficult. And there is a reality of evil in the world. This is not a hypothetical question.
Can I ask one as well?
Yeah.
I'm just thinking that you speak of the heaping burning coals on their head. So I can do that one a lot easier. Sorry.
It's one thing to pray for those that persecute you, mm-hmm. but somewhere in the back of my head, I've got that little, oh, because I'm going to heap burning coals on their head. So I can do that one so much easier, but I feel like I need to let that chunk go, and I don't know how I go from that. I don't know how to bridge those two things without thinking that, oh, God's going to get them for me.
Yeah. I think the best thing to just say is just acknowledge that that is hard. There is not an easy answer to working through that, because we are humans who feel the weight of that and want somebody else to pay for what's happened. My only thought in that regard is we are so grateful when God's grace extends to us and we end up not having to pay for things that maybe we have said or done. The other thing I'll say is that there are, in the normal scope of human life, there are consequences to things. And so to seek someone's good doesn't mean that there won't be consequences. You know, a really basic example in church life is if there's somebody who has abused a child, we want them to receive the love and grace of God, but we are not putting them to work with our kids. Like, there are human consequences to things that we need to acknowledge. This is why we get to this. I think it is the hardest of these teachings. It's the way they took it. Love your neighbor and hate your enemy. That's so much easier. I wish, there are lots of days I wish we could do that. I don't have as many answers as much as this is the call that Jesus has for us. Doesn't mean we let evil run rampant. It means that we remain committed to seeing others, even our enemies, as people created in God's image and worthy in some way of love. You know, I have such a deep appreciation for those here who work at Waypoint, because some of what people have done there just horrifies me. And they seek to go in and love them in the way of Jesus, even though the evil that has happened is real. We seek to bless and not curse, to do good and not harm, to pray to God for their good. I think a big part of that praying to God is, okay, God, help me to do this thing that is impossible for me to do. We can't do it without God's strength. This isn't something we can just give a pep talk this morning and say, hey, see, look what we're supposed to do, so let's all go and do that. That's not the reality. This is an impossible thing that we need God's strength to do it. As we do it, in the words of Jesus, you, I, we will be acting as true children of our Father in heaven. So let's pray to that end.